When they start to do that, it will be sheer oversight if they don't hang me too. Axel, the imperialist lackey who spied for you in Austria. Axel, the revanchist, Titoist, Trotskyist typist, who was your accomplice in Bern. They would prefer an American. But in the meantime, they will stretch a point and hang an Englishman until they can get hold of the real thing. He flopped back, his fury exhausted. We've got to get out of this, Sir Magnus, he repeated. We've got to rise, rise, rise. I am sick of bad superiors, bad food, bad prisons, and bad torturers. He drew angrily on his cigar again. It's time I looked after your career, and you looked after mine. And this time properly. No bourgeois shrinking back from the big scoops. This time we are professionals. We make straight for the biggest diamonds, the biggest banks. I mean it. Suddenly Axel turned his chair until it was facing Pym. Then sat on it again, and laughed, and tapped Pym smartly on the shoulder with the back of his hand to cheer him up. You got the flowers okay, Sir Magnus? They were super. Someone handed them into our cab as we were leaving the reception. Did Belinda like them? Belinda doesn't know about you. I never told her. Who did you say the flowers were from? I said I'd no idea. Probably for another wedding altogether. That was good. What's she like? Super. We were childhood sweethearts together. I thought Jemima was your childhood sweetheart. Well, Belinda was too. At the same time, both of them. That's quite a childhood you had, Axel said, with a fresh laugh as he refilled Pym's glass. Pym managed to laugh too, and they drank together. Then Axel began speaking, kindly and gently, without irony or bitterness. And it seems to me that he spoke for about 30 years, because his words are as loud in my ear now as they ever were in Pym's then. Never mind the din of the cicadas and the cheeping of the bats. Sir Magnus, you have in the past betrayed me, but more important, you have betrayed yourself. Even when you are telling the truth, you lie. You have loyalty and you have affection, but to what? To whom? I don't know all the reasons for this. Your great father, your aristocratic mother. One day maybe you will tell me. And maybe you have put your love in some bad places now and then. He leaned forward, and there was a kindly, true affection in his face, and a warm, long-suffering smile in his eyes. Yet you also have morality. You search. What I am saying is, Sir Magnus, for once nature has produced a perfect match. You are a perfect spy. All you need is a cause. I have it. I know that our revolution is young, and that sometimes the wrong people are running it. In the pursuit of peace, we are making too much war. In the pursuit of freedom, we are building too many prisons. But in the long run, I don't mind. Because I know this. All the junk that made you what you are. The privileges, the snobbery, the hypocrisy, the churches, the schools, the fathers, the class systems, the historical lies, the little lords of the countryside, the little lords of big business, and all the greedy wars that result from them. We are sweeping that away forever. For your sake. Because we are making a society that will never produce such sad little fellows as Sir Magnus. He held out his hand. So. I've said it. You are a good man, and I love you. And I remember that touch always. I can see it any time by looking into my own palm, dry and decent and forgiving. And the laughter, from the heart as it always was, once he had ceased to be tactical and become my friend again. Chapter 16. How appropriate, Tom, that looking back over all the years that follow our meeting in the Czech summer house, I see nothing but America. America, her golden shores glittering on the horizon like the promise of freedom after the repressions of our troubled Europe, then leaping towards us in the summer joy of our attainment.
Pym still has more than a quarter of a century in which to serve his two houses, according to the best standards of his omnivorous loyalty. The trained, married, case-hardened elderly adolescent has still to become a man, though who will ever break the genetic code of when a middle-class Englishman's adolescence ends and his manhood takes over? Half a dozen dangerous European cities, from Prague to Berlin to Stockholm to the occupied capital of his native England, lie between the two friends and their goal. Yet it seems to me now they were no more than staging places where we could provision and refurbish and watch the stars in preparation for our journey. And consider for a moment the dreadful alternative, Tom, the fear of failure that blew like a Siberian wind on our unprotected backs. Consider what it would have meant to two men such as ourselves to have lived out our lives as spies without ever having spied on America. It must be said quickly, lest there is any doubt of it left in your mind, that after the summer house, Pym's path was set for life. He had renewed his vow, and in the terms your Uncle Jack and I have always lived by, Tom, there was no way out. Pym was owned and hooked and pledged. Finish. After the barn in Austria, well, yes, there had been a little latitude still, though never any prospect of redemption. And you have seen how, if feebly, he did try to jump clear of the secret world and brave the hazards of the real one. Not with any conviction, true, but he made a stab at it, even if he knew he would be about as much use out there as a beached fish dying of too much oxygen. But after the summer house, God's brief to Pym was clear. No more dithering. Stay put in your proper station, in the element to which nature has appointed you. Pym needed no third telling. "Make a clean breast of it," I hear you cry, Tom. "Hurry home to London, go to personnel, pay the penalty, begin again." Well now, Pym thought of that. Naturally he did. On the drive back to Vienna, on the aeroplane home, on the bus to London from Heathrow, Pym did a lot of energetic agonizing along those lines. For it was one of the occasions when the whole of his life was pinned up in a vivid strip cartoon inside his skull. "Begin where?" he asked himself, not unreasonably. With Lipsy, whose death in his gloomier hours he was still determined to take upon himself? With Sefton Boyd's initials? With poor Dorothy, whom he had driven off her head? With Peggy Wentworth, screaming her dirt at him, another victim for sure? Or with the day he first picked the locks of Rick's green cabinet or Membury's desk? How many of the systems of his life exactly are you proposing that he bear to the guilt-bestowing gaze of his admirers? Then resign! Bolt to Murgo! Take the teaching job at Willows! Pym thought of that, too. He thought of half a dozen dark holes where he could bury his leftover life and hide his guilty charm. Not one of them attracted him for 5 minutes. Would Axel's people really have exposed Pym if he had cut and run? I doubt it. But that isn't the point. The point is, Pym quite frequently loved the firm as much as he loved Axel. He adored its rough, uncomprehending trust in him, its misuse of him, its tweedy bear hugs, flawed romanticism, and cockeyed integrity. He smiled to himself each time he stepped inside its Reichskanzleis and safe palaces, accepted the unsmiling salute of its vigilant janitors. The firm was home and school and court to him, even when he was betraying it. He really felt he had a lot to give it, just as he had a lot to give to Axel. In his imagination, he saw himself with cellars full of nylons and black market chocolate, enough to see everybody right in every shortage. And intelligence is nothing if not an institutionalized black market in perishable commodities. And this time Pym himself was the hero of the fable. No Membury stood between himself and the fraternity. Suppose that on a lonely drive to Pilsen, Sir Magnus, you stopped your car to give a lift to a couple of workmen on their way to work. You would do that? Axel had suggested, in the small hours of the morning in the summer house, when he had put Pym back together again. Pym conceded that he might. And suppose, Sir Magnus, that as simple fellows will, they had confided to you, as you drove along, their fears about handling radioactive material without sufficient protective clothing. You would prick up your ears? Pym laughed and agreed that he would. And suppose also that as a great operator and a generous spirit, Sir Magnus, you had written down their names and addresses, and promised to bring them a pound or two of good English coffee next time you visited their region. Pym said he would certainly have done that. And suppose, Axel continued, that having driven these fellows to the outer perimeter of the protected area where they work, you had the courage and the initiative and the officer qualities, as you assuredly have, to park your car in a discreet spot and climb this hill. Axel was indicating the very hill on a military map he happened to have brought along with him and spread over the iron table. And from its apex you photograph the factory using the convenient protection of a thicket of lime trees, whose lower branches are later discovered to have slightly marred the pictures. Your aristos would admire your enterprise. They would applaud the great Sir Magnus. They would instruct him to recruit the two loquacious workmen and obtain further details of the factory's output and purpose. They surely would, said Pym vigorously. Congratulations, Sir Magnus. Axel drops the very film into Pym's waiting palm, the firm's own issue, wrapped in anonymous green. Pym secretes it in his typewriter. Pym hands it to his masters. The wonder does not stop there. When the product is rushed to the Whitehall analysts, the factory turns out to be the very plant recently photographed from the air by an American overflight. With a show of reluctance, Pym supplies the personal particulars of his two innocent and thus far fictitious informants. The names are filed, carded, checked, processed, and banded round the senior officer's bar, until finally, under the divine laws of bureaucracy, they are the subject of a special committee. Look here, young Pym, what makes you think these chaps aren't going to turn you in next time you show up on their doorstep? But Pym is in interview mode. He has a large audience and is invincible. It's a hunch, sir, that's all. Count two slowly. I think they trusted me. I think they're keeping their mouths shut and hoping I'll show up one evening exactly as I said I would. And events prove him right, as they would, wouldn't they, Jack? Braving all, our hero returns to Checo and repairs, regardless of risk, to their very doorsteps. How can he fail to, since he is escorted there by Axel, who makes the introductions? For this time, there will be no Sergeant Pavels. A loyal, bright-eyed repertory company of actors has been born. Axel is its producer, and these are its founder members. Painfully and dangerously, the network is built upon. By Pym, a cool number if ever we knew one. Pym, the latest hero of the corridors, the chap who put Conger together. The firm's systems of natural selection, accelerated by Jack Brotherhood's promptings, can no longer be resisted.
Join the Foreign Office, Belinda's father echoes in heavy artificial mystification. Post it to Prague? How do you do that from a deadbeat electronics firm? Well, well, I must say.
It's a contract appointment. They need Czech speakers, says Pym. He's boosting British trade, Daddy. You wouldn't understand. You're just a stockbroker, says Belinda.
Well, they might at least give him a decent cover story, mightn't they? Says Belinda's father, laughing his infuriating laugh.
In the firm's newest and most secret safe flat in Prague, Pym and Axel drink to Pym's instatement as Second Secretary Commercial and Visa Officer at the British Embassy. Axel has fattened, Pym observes with pleasure. The lines of suffering are clearing from his haggard features.
To the land of the free, Sir Magnus.
To America, says Pym. My dearest father, I am so glad you approve of my appointment. Unfortunately, I am not yet in a position to persuade Pandit Nehru to grant you an audience so that you can put your football pool scheme to him, though I can well imagine the boost it might give to the struggling Indian economy. So, were there no genuine Joes at all, I hear you asking, Tom, in a tone of disappointment? Were they all pretend? Indeed, there were genuine Joes, never fear. And very good they were too, the best. And every one of them profited from Pym's improved tradecraft, and looked up to Pym as he looked up to Axel. And Pym and Axel looked up to the genuine Joes also in their fashion, regarding them as the unwitting ambassadors of the operation, testifying to its smooth running and integrity, and used their good offices to shield and advance them, arguing that every improvement in their circumstances brought glory to the networks, and smuggle them to Austria for clandestine training and rehabilitation. The genuine Joes were our mascots, Tom, our stars. We made sure they would never want for anything again, so long as Pym and Axel were there to see them right. Which, as a matter of fact, is how it all went wrong. But later. I wish I could adequately describe to you, Jack, the pleasure of being really well run. Of jealousy, of ideology, nothing. Axel was as keen for Pym to love England as he was to direct him at America. And it was part of his genius throughout our partnership to praise the freedoms of the West while tacitly implying that Pym had it within his reach, if not his duty as a free man, to bring some of this freedom to the East. Oh, you may laugh, Jack, and you may shake your grey hairs at the depth of Pym's innocence. But can you not imagine how easily it came to Pym to take a tiny, impoverished country into his protection, when his own was so favoured, so victorious and well-born? And from where he saw it, so absurd. To love poor Cecco like a rich protector through all her terrible vicissitudes, for Axel's sake. To forgive her lapses in advance, and blame them on the many betrayals that his parent England had perpetrated against her. Does it honestly amaze you that Pym, by making bonds with the forbidden, should be once more escaping from what held him? That he who had loved his way across so many borders should now be loving his way across another, with Axel there to show him how to walk and where to cross. "I'm sorry, Belle," Pym would say to Belinda, as he abandoned her yet again to the scrabble board in their dark apartment in Prague's diplomatic ghetto. "Got to go up country. Maybe a day or two. Come on, Belle. Kiss, kiss. You wouldn't rather be married to a 9-till-5 man, would you?" "I can't find the Times," she said, shaking him aside. "I suppose you left it at the bloody embassy again." But however frayed Pym's nerves when he arrived at the rendezvous, Axel reclaimed him every time they met. He was never hasty, never importunate. He was never anything but respectful of the pains and sensibilities of his agent. It was not stasis one side and all movement the other either, Tom. Far from it. Axel's ambitions were for himself as well as Pym. Was not Pym his rice bowl, his fortune in all its meanings, his passport to the privileges and status of a paid-up party aristo? Oh, how he studied Pym, how delicately he coaxed and gentled him, how meticulous he was, always to put on the clothes Pym needed him to wear. Now the mantle of the wise and steady father Pym had never had. Now the bloody rags of suffering that were the uniform of his authority. Now the soutane of Pym's one confessor, his Murgo absolute. He had to learn Pym's codes and evasions. He had to read Pym faster than he could ever read himself. He had to scold and forgive him like the parents who would never slam the door in his face, laugh where Pym was melancholy, and keep the flame of all Pym's faiths alive when he was down and saying, "I can't, I'm lonely and afraid." Above all, he had to keep his agent's wits constantly alert against the seemingly limitless tolerance of the firm. For how could we ever dare believe, either of us, that the dear dead wood of England was not a cladding for some masterly game being played inside? Imagine the headaches Axel had, as Pym went on producing his mountains of intelligence material, to persuade his masters they were not the victims of some grand imperialist deception. The Czechs admired you so much, Jack. The old ones knew you from the war. They knew your skills and respected them. They knew the dangers every day of underestimating their wily adversary. Axel had to fight toe to toe with them more than once. He had to argue with the very henchmen who had tortured him in order to prevent them from pulling Pym out of the field and giving him a little of the medicine they periodically dished out to one another on the off chance of extracting a true confession from him. "Yes, I am Brotherhood's man," they wanted him to scream. "Yes, I am here to plant disinformation on you, to distract your eye from our anti-socialist operations. And yes, Axel is my accomplice. Take me, hang me, anything but this." But Axel prevailed. He begged and bullied and slammed the table. And when still more purges were planned to explain the chaos left behind by the last ones, he scared his enemies into silence by threatening to expose them for their insufficient appreciation of the historically inevitable imperialist decay. And Pym helped him every inch of the distance, sat again at his sickbed, if only metaphorically, gave him nourishment and courage, held up his spirits, ransacked the station files, armed him with outrageous examples of the firm's incompetence worldwide, until, fighting thus for their mutual survival, Pym and Axel drew still closer together, each laying the irrational burdens of his country at the other's feet. And once in a while, when a battle was over and won, or a great scoop had been achieved on one side or the other, Axel would put on the play clothes of the libertine and arrange a midnight dash to his frugal equivalent of St. Moritz, which was a small white castle in the giant mountains, set aside by his service for people they thought the world of. The first time they went there was for an anniversary celebration, in a limousine with blackened windows. Pym had been in Prague 2 years. "I have decided to present you with an excellent new agent, Sir Magnus," Axel announced, as they zigzagged contentedly up the gravel road. "The Watchman network is lamentably short of industrial intelligence. The Americans are pledged to the collapse of our economy, but the firm is providing nothing to support their optimism. How would you regard a middle executive from our great National Bank of Czechoslovakia, with access to some of our most serious mismanagements?"
"Where am I supposed to have found him?" Pym countered cautiously, for these were delicate decisions, requiring lengthy correspondence with head office before the approach to a new potential source was licensed. The dinner table was laid for three, the candelabra lit. The two men had taken a long, slow walk in the forest, and now they were drinking an aperitif before the fire, waiting for their guest.
"How is Belinda?" said Axel.
This was not a subject they often discussed, for Axel had little patience with unsatisfactory relationships.
"Fine, thank you, as always."
"That's not what our microphones tell us. They say you fight like two dogs day and night. Our listeners are becoming thoroughly depressed by you both."
"Tell them we'll mend our ways," said Pym, with a rare flash of bitterness.
A car was coming up the hill. They heard the footsteps of the old servant crossing the hall and the rattle of bolts.
"Meet your new agent," Axel said. The door banged open, and Sabina marched in. A little more matronly, perhaps, at the hips, one or two hard lines of officialdom around the jaw, but his delicious Sabina all the same. She was wearing a stern black dress with a white collar, and clumpy black court shoes that must have been her pride, for they had green brilliance on the straps, and the sheen of imitation suede. Seeing Pym, she drew up sharply and scowled at him in suspicion. For a moment her manner reflected the most radical disapproval. Then, to his delight, she burst out laughing her crazy Slav laugh, and ran to cover him with her body, much as she had done in Graz when he took his first faltering lessons in Czech.
"And so it was, Jack." Sabina rose and rose until she became the head agent of the Watchman Network, and the darling of her successive British case officers, though you knew her either as Watchman One or as the intrepid Olga Krivitsky, secretary to the Prague Internal Committee on Economic Affairs. We retired her, if you remember, when she was expecting her third baby by her fourth husband, at a special dinner for her in West Berlin, while she was attending her last conference of Comic-Con bankers in Potsdam. Axel kept her on a little longer before he decided to follow your example.
"I've been posted to Berlin," Pym told Belinda, in the safety of a public park, at the end of his second tour in Prague.
"Why are you telling me?" said Belinda.
"I wondered whether you'd like to come," Pym replied, and Belinda began coughing again, her long unquestionable cough that she must have picked up from the climate.
Belinda went back to London and took an open university course in journalism, though none in silent killing. Eventually, in her 37th year, she launched herself upon the hazardous path of fashionable liberal causes, where, after encountering several Pauls, she married one, and had an unruly daughter, who criticized her for everything she did, which gave Belinda the feeling of being reconciled with her own parents. And Pim and Axel embarked on the next leg of their pilgrim's voyage. In Berlin, a brighter future awaited them, and a maturer treason. Care of Colonel Evelyn Tremaine, DSO, Pioneer Corps, retired. P.O. Box 9077, Manila. To His Excellency Sir Magnus Richard Pym, Decorations, the British High Mission, Berlin. My dearest son, merely a note which I hope does not inconvenience you on your way to the top, since none should expect gratitude until it is his turn to stand before the father of us all, which I expect to be doing at an early date. Medical science being still at a primitive stage here, it appears notwithstanding that this cruel summer is likely to be the writer's last, despite sacrifice of alcohol and other comforts. If you are sending for treatment or funeral, be sure to make out check and envelope to the colonel, not self, as the name of Pym is persona non gratis to the natives, and anyway may be dead. Praying to be spared, Rick T. Pym. P.S. I am advised that 916 gold may be had in Berlin at knockdown price, the diplomatic bag being available to those in high position seeking opportunity for informal reward. Persloft is at old address and will assist for 10%. But watch him. Berlin. What a garrison of spies, Tom. What a cabinet full of useless liquid secrets. What a playground for every alchemist, miracle worker and rat piper that ever took up the cloak and turned his face from the unpalatable constraints of political reality. And always at the centre, the great good American heart, bravely drumming out its honourable rhythms in the name of liberty, democracy, and setting the people free. In Berlin, the firm had agents of influence, agents of disruption, subversion, sabotage and disinformation. We even had one or two who supplied us with intelligence, though these were an underprivileged crowd, kept on more out of a traditional regard than any intrinsic professional worth. We had tunnellers and smugglers, listeners and forgers, trainers and recruiters and talent spotters, and couriers and watchers and seducers, assassins and balloonists, lip readers and disguise artists. But whatever the Brits had, the Americans had more. And whatever the Americans had, the East Germans had 5 of it, and the Russians 10 of it. Pym stood before these marvels like a child let loose in a sweet shop, not knowing what to grab first. And Axel, slipping in and out of the city on any number of false passports, padded softly behind him with his basket. In safe flats and dark restaurants, never the same one twice, we ate quiet meals, exchanged our goods, and gazed upon each other with the incredulous contentment that passes between mountaineers when they are standing on the peak. But even then, we never forgot the bigger peak that lay ahead of us as we raised our vodka glasses to each other and whispered, "Next year in America," across the candlelight. And the committees, Tom. Berlin was not safe enough to contain them. We assembled in London, in gilded imperial chambers, appropriate to players of the world's game. And such a bold, diverse, brilliantly inventive cross-section of our society's leaders we were. For these were the new years of England, when the country's hidden talent would be winkled from its shell and harnessed to the nation's service. "Spies are blinkered," went the cry. "Too incestuous." For Berlin, we must open the doors to the real world of dons, barristers and journalists. We need bankers and trade unionists and industrialists. Chaps who put their money where their mouths are and know what makes the world tick. We need members of parliament who can supply a whiff of the hustings and utter stern words about taxpayers' money. And what happened to these wise men, Tom? These shrewd, no-nonsense outsiders? Watchdogs of the secret war? They rushed in where even the spies might have feared to tread. Too long frustrated by the limitations of the overt world, these brilliant, unfettered minds fell overnight in love with every conspiracy, skullduggery and shortcut you can imagine. "Do you know what they're dreaming up now?" Pym raged, pacing the carpet of the service flat in Lowndes Square, which Axel had rented for the duration of an Anglo-American conference on unofficial action.
Calm yourself, Sir Magnus. Have another drink.
Calm myself? When these lunatics are seriously proposing to plug themselves into the Soviet ground control, talk a MiG over American airspace, blow it out of the sky, and, if the pilot by any chance survives, offer him the choice of being put on trial for espionage or staging a public defection in front of the microphones. That's the defense editor of the Guardian newspaper speaking, for Christ's sake. He'll start a war. He wants to. It will give him something to report at last. He was backed by a nephew of the Archbishop of Canterbury and a deputy director general of the BBC. But Axel's love of England would not be spoiled by Pym's prissiness. Through the passenger window of a self-drive Ford from the firm's carpool, he gazed at Buckingham Palace and softly clapped his hands when he saw the royal pennant fluttering in its arc light. Go back to Berlin, Sir Magnus. One day it will be the Stars and Stripes. His Berlin apartment was in the centre of the Kurfürstendamm, on the top floor of a sprawling Biedermeier house that had miraculously survived the bombing. His bedroom was on the garden side, so he didn't hear their car pull up. But he heard their spongy footsteps on the stairs, and had a memory of the Fremdenpolizei stealing up Herr Ollinger's wooden staircase in the early hours that policemen liked the best, and Pym knew it was the end. Though, of all the ways he had imagined the end, he hadn't expected it to come this way. Field men feel those things and learn to trust them, and Pym was a field man twice over. So he knew it was the end, and in a quiet way he was neither surprised nor disconcerted. He was out of bed and into the kitchen in a second, because the kitchen was where he'd been concealing the rolls of film for his next rendezvous with Axel. By the time they pressed the doorbell, he had unrolled 6 reels and exposed them, and touched off the instant ignition code pad that he had hidden in an oilskin inside the lavatory cistern. In his clear-eyed acceptance of his fate, he even contemplated something rather more drastic, for Berlin was no Vienna, and he kept a pistol in his bedside locker, and another in a drawer in the hall. But something about the apologetic way they murmured, "Herr Pym, wake up, please," through the letterbox, discouraged him, and when he looked through the peephole and saw the amiable shape of Police Lieutenant Dollendorf and the young sergeant at his side, a shaming awareness came over him of the shock he would cause them if he took that path. "So they're pulling a soft entry," he thought as he opened the door. "First you spread your wolf children round the building, then you put in Mr. Nice Guy by the front door." Lieutenant Dollendorf, like most people in Berlin, was a client of Jack Brotherhood, and earned a small retainer by looking the other way when agents were being hustled back and forth across the profitable stretch of wall in his district. He was a cosy Bavarian fellow, with all the Bavarian appetites, and his breath smelt permanently of Weisswurst.
"Forgive us, Herr Pym. Excuse the disturbances so late," he began, smiling too broadly.
He was in uniform. His gun was still in its holster.
"Our Herr Commandant asks that you come immediately to headquarters on a personal and urgent matter," he explained, still not touching his gun.
There was resolution in Dollendorf's voice, as well as embarrassment, however, and his sergeant was peering sharply up and down the stairwell.
"The Herr Commandant assures me that everything can be arranged discreetly, Herr Pym. He wishes at this stage to be delicate. He has made no approach to your superiors," Dollendorf insisted, as Pym still hesitated. "The Commandant has high respect for you, Herr Pym."
"I have to dress."
"But quickly, if you are so kind, Herr Pym. The Commandant would like the matter dealt with before he has to hand it over to the day shift."
Pym turned and walked carefully to his bedroom. He waited to hear the policeman following him, or a barked order, but they preferred to remain in the hall, looking at the cries of London prints, courtesy of the firm's accommodation section.
"May I use your telephone, Herr Pym?"
"Go ahead." He dressed with the door open, hoping to overhear the conversation. But all he heard was,
"Everything in order, Herr Commandant? Our man is coming immediately."
They walked down the broad stairs 3 abreast, to a parked police car with its light flashing. Nothing behind it. No late-night loiterers in the street. How typical of the Germans to disinfect the entire area before arresting him. Pym sat in the front with Dollendorf. The sergeant sat tensely behind. It was raining, and 2 in the morning. A red sky was seething with black cloud. Nobody spoke any more. "And at the police station, Jack will be waiting," thought Pym. "Or the military police. Or God." The commandant rose to receive him. Dollendorf and his sergeant faded away. The commandant considered himself a man of supernatural subtlety. He was tall and grey and hollow-backed, with staring eyes and a narrow, rattling mouth that operated at self-destructive speed. He leaned back in his chair and put his fingertips together. He spoke in an anguished monotone to an etching of his birthplace in East Prussia that was hanging on the wall above Pym's head. He spoke, in Pym's calm estimation, for about 6 hours without a break and without appearing to draw breath, which for the commandant was the equivalent of a quick warm-up before they got down to a serious discussion. The commandant said that he was a man of the world and a family man, conversant with what he called the intimate sphere. Pym said he respected this. The commandant said he was not didactic, he was not political, though he was a Christian Democrat. He was evangelical, but Pym could rest assured that he had no quarrel with Roman Catholics. Pym said he would have expected no less. The commandant said that misdeeds were a spectrum that ran between pardonable human error and calculated crime. Pym agreed, and heard a footfall in the corridor. The commandant begged Pym to bear in mind that foreigners in a strange country frequently felt a sense of false security when contemplating what might strictly be regarded as a felonious act. "I may speak frankly, Herr Pym?" "Please do," said Pym, in whom, by now, a fearful premonition was beginning to form that it was Axel, not himself, who was under arrest. "When they brought him to me, I looked at him, I listened to him, I said, 'No, this cannot be, not Herr Pym. The man is an impostor,' I said. 'He is trading upon a distinguished connection.' However, as I continued to listen to him, I detected a sense of, shall I say, vision. There is an energy here, an intelligence. I may say also a charm. Possibly, I thought, this man is who he says he is. Only Herr Pym can tell us, I thought." He pressed a button on his desk. "I may confront him with you, Herr Pym?" An old turnkey appeared and waddled ahead of them down a painted brick corridor that stank of carbolic. He unlocked a grill and closed it behind them. He unlocked another. "It was the first time I had seen Rick in prison, Tom, and I have made sure ever since that it was the last. In future times, Pym sent him food, clothes, cigars, and in Ireland, Drambuie. Pym emptied his bank account for him. And if he had been a millionaire, he would have bankrupted himself rather than see him there again, even in his mind's eye." Rick sat in the corner, and Pym knew at once that he did this in order to give himself a bigger view of the cell. For ever since I had known him, he always needed more space than God had given him. He sat with his great head tipped forward, scowling with a lag's sullenness. And I swear he had closed off his hearing with his thinking and hadn't heard us coming. "Father," said Pym. "It's me." Rick came to the bars and put a hand each side and his face between. He stared first at Pym, then at the commandant and the turnkey, not understanding Pym's position. His expression was sleepy and bad-tempered.
"So they got you too, did they, son?" he said.
Not, I thought, without a certain satisfaction.
"I always thought you were up to something. You should have read law, like I told you."
Slowly the truth began to dawn on him. The turnkey unlocked his door. The good commandant said, "Please help him," and stood aside for Pym to enter. Pym went to Rick and put his arms round him, but delicately, in case they had been beating him and he was sore. Gradually the puff began to fill Rick up again.
"God in heaven, old son, what the devil are they doing to me? Can't an honest fellow do a bit of business in this country?
Have you seen the food they give you here, these German sausages? What do we pay our taxes for? What did we fight the war for? What's the good of a son who's head of the Foreign Office if he can't keep these German thugs away from his old man? But by then, Pym was bear-hugging Rick, slapping his shoulders, and saying it was good to see him in whatever circumstances. So Rick took to weeping also, and the commandant delicately removed himself to another room, while, reunited, each pal celebrated the other as his saviour. "I don't mean to disappoint you, Tom, but I do honestly forget, perhaps deliberately, the details of Rick's Berlin transactions. Pym was expecting his own judgment at the time, not Rick's. I remember two sisters, and that they were of noble Prussian stock, and lived in an old house in Charlottenburg, because Pym called on them to pay them off for the usual missing paintings Rick was selling for them, and the diamond brooch was getting cleaned for them, and the fur coats that were being remodelled by a first-rate tailor friend of his in London, who would do it free, because he thought the world of Rick. And I remember the sisters had a bent nephew, who was involved in a shady arms racket, and that somewhere in the story, Rick had an aeroplane for sale. The finest, best-preserved fighter bomber you could wish for, in mint condition, inside and out. And for all I know, it was being painted by those lifelong liberals, Ballams of Brinkley, and guaranteed to fly everyone to heaven. It was in Berlin, also, that Pym courted your mother, Tom, and took her away from his boss and hers, Jack Brotherhood. I'm not sure that you or anybody else has a natural right to know what accident conceived him, but I'll try to help you as best I can. There was mischief in Pym's motive, I won't deny it. The love, what there was of it, came later. Jack Brotherhood and I seem to be sharing the same woman, Pym remarked impishly to Axel one day, during a call-box-to-call-box conversation. Axel required to know immediately who she was. An aristo, said Pym, still teasing him. One of ours. Church and spy establishment, if that means anything to you. Her family's connections with the firm go back to William the Conqueror. Is she married? You know I don't sleep with married women unless they absolutely insist. Is she amusing? Axel, we're talking of a lady. I mean, is she social? Axel demanded impatiently. Is she what you call diplomatic geisha? Is she bourgeois? Would Americans like her? She's a top Martha, Axel, I keep telling you. She's beautiful and rich and frightfully British. Then maybe she is the ticket that will get us to Washington, said Axel, who had recently been expressing anxieties about the number of random women drifting through Pym's life. Soon afterwards, Pym received similar advice from your Uncle Jack. Mary has told me what's going on between you, Magnus, he said, taking him aside in his most avuncular manner. And if you ask me, you could travel further and fare a damned sight worse. She's one of the best girls we've got, and it's time you looked a little less disreputable. So Pym, with both his mentors pushing in the same direction, followed their advice, and took Mary, your mother, to be his truly wedded partner at the high table of the Anglo-American Alliance. And really, after all that he had given away already, it seemed a very reasonable sacrifice. Hold his hand, Jack, Pym wrote. He's the dearest thing I had. Mabs, forgive, Pym wrote. Dear, dear Mabs, forgive. If love is whatever we can still betray, remember that I betrayed you on a lot of days. He began a note to Kate and tore it up. He scribbled, Dearest Belinda, and stopped, scared by the silence around him. He looked sharply at his watch. 5 o'clock. Why hasn't the clock chimed? I've gone deaf. I'm dead. I'm in a padded cell. From across the square, the first chime sounded. 1, 2. I can stop it any time I want, he thought. I can stop it at 1, at 2, at 3. I can take any part of any hour and stop it dead. What I cannot do is make it chime midnight at 1 o'clock. That's God's trick,
Not mine. A shocked stillness had descended over Pym, and it was the literal stillness of death. He was standing at the window once more, watching the leaves drift across the empty square. An ominous inactivity marked everything he saw. Not a head in a window, not an open doorway, not a dog or a cat or a squirrel, or a single squawking child. They have taken to the hills. They are waiting for the raiders from the sea. But in his head, he is standing in the cellar flat of a run-down office block in Cheapside, watching the two faded lovelies on their knees as they tear open the last of Rick's files and lick their crabbed fingertips to speed them in their paper chase. Paper lies in growing mounds around them. It flutters through the air like swirling petals as they rummage and discard what they have vainly plundered. Bank statements written in blood, invoices, furious solicitors' letters, warrants, summonses, love letters dripping with reproach. The dust of them is filling Pym's nostrils as he watches. The clang of the steel drawers is like the clang of his prison grills. But the lovelies heed nothing. They are avid widows ransacking Rick's record. At the centre of the debris, drawers and cupboards askew, stands Rick's last Reichskanzlei desk, its serpents twining themselves round its Bombay legs like gilded garters. On the wall hangs the last photograph of the great TP in mayoral regalia. And on the chimneypiece, above a grate stuffed with false coals and the last of Rick's cigar butts, stands the bronze bust of your founder and managing director himself, beaming out the last of his integrity. On the open door at Pym's back hangs the memorial tablet to Rick's last dozen companies. But a sign beside the bell reads, "Press here for attention." Because when Rick has not been saving his nation's faltering economy, he has been working as night porter for the block. "What time did he die?" says Pym, before remembering that he knows.
"Evening, dearie. The pubs was just opening," says one of the lovelies through her cigarette as she heaves another batch of paper onto the rubbish heap.
"He was having a nice drop next door," says the other,
who, like the first, has not for a moment relaxed her labours.
"What's next door?" says Pym.
"Bedroom,"
says the first lovely, tossing aside another spent file.
"So, who was with him?" Pym asks. "Were you with him? Who was with him, please?"
"We both were, dearie," says the second. "We was having a little cuddle, if you want to know. Your dad loved a drink, and it always made him amorous. We'd had a nice supper early because of his commitments, steak with onion, and he'd had a bit of a barney on the blower with the telephone exchange about a cheque that was in the post to them. He was depressed, wasn't he, Vi?" The first lovely, if reluctantly, suspends her researches. The second does likewise. Suddenly they are decent London women, with kindly faces and puffed, overworked bodies. "It was over for him, dearie," she says,
pushing away a hang of hair with her chubby wrist.
"What was?"
"He said if he couldn't have that phone no more, he'd have to go. He said that phone was his lifeline, and if he couldn't have it, it was a judgment on him. How would he do his business without a blower and a clean shirt?"
Mistaking Pym's silence for rebuke, her companion flares at him.
"Don't look at us like that, darling. He'd had all we've got long ago. We'd done the gas, we'd done the electric. We cooked his dinners, didn't we, Vi?"
"We'd done all we could," says Vi. "And given him the comfort, too."
"We pulled tricks for him more than was natural, didn't we, Vi? 3 a day for him sometimes."
"More," says Vi.
"He was very lucky to have you," says Pym, sincerely. "Thank you very much for looking after him."
This pleases them, and they smile shyly.
"You haven't got a nice bottle in that big black briefcase of yours, I suppose, dearie?"
"I'm afraid not."
Vi goes to the bedroom. Through the open doorway, Pym sees the great imperial bed from Chester Street, its upholstery ripped and stained with use. Rick's silk pyjamas lie sprawled across the coverlet. He smells Rick's body lotion and Rick's hair oil. Vi returns with a bottle of Drambuie.
"Did he talk about me at all in the last days?" says Pym, while they drink.
"He was proud of you, dear," says Vi's friend. "Very proud."
but she seems dissatisfied with her reply.
He was going to catch you up, mind.
That was nearly his last words, wasn't it, Vi?
We was holding him, says Vi, with a sniff. You could see he was going from the breathing. Tell them I forgive them at the telephone exchange, he says. And tell my boy Magnus we'll both be ambassadors soon.
And after that, says Pim.
Give us another touch of the Napoleon, Vi, says Vi's friend, now weeping also.
It wasn't Napoleon, though. It was the Drambuie. Then he says,
there's enough in those files, girls, to see you write till you join me.
He just nodded off, really, says Vi, into her handkerchief.
He mightn't have been dead at all, if it hadn't been for his heart.
There is a rustle at the door. Three knocks. Vi opens it an inch, then all the way, then stands back disapprovingly to admit Ollie and Mr. Cudlove, armed with buckets of ice. The years have not been kind to Ollie's nerves, and the tears at the corners of his eyes are stained with mascara. But Mr. Cudlove is unchanged, down to his chauffeur's black tie. Transferring the bucket to his left side, Mr. Cudlove seizes Pim's right hand in a manly grip. Pim follows them down a narrow corridor, lined with photographs of never-wasers. Rick is lying in the bath with a towel around his middle, his marbled feet crossed over each other, as if in accordance with some oriental ritual. His hands are curled and cupped in readiness to harangue his maker.
It's just that there wasn't the funds, sir,
Mr. Cudlove murmurs, while Ollie pours in the ice.
Not a penny piece anywhere, to be frank, sir. I think those ladies may have taken a liberty.
Why didn't you close his eyes? Says Pim.
We did, sir, to be frank, but they would open again, and it didn't seem respectful.
On one knee before his father, Pim writes out a cheque for £200, and nearly makes it dollars by mistake. Pim drives to Chester Street. The house has been in other hands for years, but tonight it stands in darkness, as if once more waiting for the distraining bailiffs. Pim approaches gingerly. On the doorstep, a nightlight burns, despite the rain. Beside it, like a dead animal, lies an old boa, in the mauve of half-mourning, similar to the one belonging to Aunt Nell that he had used to block the lavatory at the Glades so long ago. Was it Dorothy's? Or Peggy Wentworth's? Was it some child's game? Was it put there by Lipsy's ghost? No card attaches to its dew-soaked feathers. No sequestrator has pinned his claim to it. The only clue is the one word, yes, scrawled in trembling chalk lines on the door, like a safety signal in a target town. Turning his back on the deserted square, Pim strode angrily to the bathroom and opened the skylight that years ago he had daubed with green paint for Miss Dover's greater decency. Through a gun slit, he examined the gardens at the side of the house and concluded that they too were unnaturally empty. No Stanley, the Alsatian, tethered to the rain tub of number 8. No Mrs. Aitken, the butcher's wife, who spends every waking hour at her roses. Closing the skylight with a bang, he stooped over the basin and sluiced water in his face, then glowered at his reflection till it gave him a false and brilliant smile. Rick's smile, put on to taunt him. The one that is too happy even to blink. The one that cuddles up against you and presses into you like a thrilled child. The one Pim hated most.
Fireworks, old son, said Pim, mimicking Rick's cadences at their holy worst. Remember how you loved a firework? Remember dear old Guy Fawkes night? And the great set piece there, with your old man's initials on it, RTP, going up in lights all over Ascot? Well then.
Well then. Pim echoed in his soul.
Pim is writing again, joyously. No pen can take the strain of this. Reckless free letters are careering over the paper. Light paths, rocket tails, stars and stripes are zipping above his head. The music of 1,000 transistor radios plays around him. The bright faces of strangers laugh into his own, and he is laughing back at them. It is the 4th of July. It is Washington's night of nights. The diplomatic Pims have arrived a week ago to take up his appointment as deputy head of station. The island of Berlin is sunk at last. They have a spell in Prague behind them, Stockholm, London. The path to America was never easy, but Pym has gone the distance. Pym has made it. He has assumed and almost risen into the reddened dark that is repeatedly blasted into whiteness by the floodlights, fireworks and searchlights. The crowd is bobbing round him, and he is part of it. The free people of the earth have taken him among them. He is one with all these grown-up happy children, celebrating their independence of things that never held them. The Marine Band, the Breckenbridge Boys Choir, and the Metropolitan Area Symposium Choral Group have wooed and won him unopposed. At party after party, Magnus and Mary have been celebrated by half the intelligence aristos of Georgetown, eaten swordfish by candlelight in red brick yards, chatted under lights strung in overhanging branches, have embraced and been embraced, shaken hands and filled their heads with names and gossip and champagne.
Heard a lot about you, Magnus. Magnus, welcome aboard. Jesus, is that your wife? That's criminal.
Till Mary, worried about Tom, the fireworks have overexcited him, is determined to go home, and B. Lederer has gone with her. I'll join you soon, darling, Pym murmurs as she leaves. Must pop in on the Wexlers, or they'll think I'm cutting them. Where am I? In the Mall? On the hill? Pym has no idea. The bare arms and thighs and unhampered breasts of young American womanhood are brushing contentedly against him. Friendly hands make space for him to pass. Laughter, pot smoke, din pack the scalding night.
What's your name, man? You British? Here, let's shake your hand. Take a swig of this.
Pym adds a mouthful of bourbon to the impressive mixture he has already taken in. He is climbing a slope, whether of grass or tarmac he cannot determine. The White House glistens below him. Before it, erect and floodlit, the white needle of the Washington Monument cuts its light path to the unreachable stars. Jefferson and Lincoln, each in his eternal patch of Rome, lie to either side of him. Pym loves them both. All the patriarchs and founding fathers of America are mine. He crests the slope. A black man offers him popcorn. It is salt and hot like his own sweat. Further up the valley, the harmless battles of other firework shows boom and splash into the sky. The crowd is denser up here, but still they smile at him and part for him while they oo and ah at the fireworks, call friendship to each other, break into patriotic song. A pretty girl is teasing him.
Hey man, why won't you dance?
Well, thank you, I will with pleasure, but just let me take off my coat, Pym replies. His answer is too wordy. She has found another partner. He is shouting. At first he does not hear himself, but as he enters a quieter place, his own voice bursts on him with startling distinctness.
Poppy! Poppy, where are you?
Helpfully, the good people round him take up the cry.
Hurry on over here, Poppy! Your boyfriend's here! Come on, Poppy, you bad bitch, where you been?
Behind and above him, the rockets become a ceaseless fountain against the swirling crimson clouds. Before him, a gold umbrella opens, embracing the whole white mountain and lighting the emptying street. Instructions are ringing remotely in Pym's head. He is reading the numbers of the streets and doorways. He finds the door, and with a final surge of joy, feels the familiar bony hand close round his wrist, and the familiar voice admonishing him. Your friend Poppy cannot come tonight, Sir Magnus, says Axel softly. So will you please stop shouting her name? Shoulder to shoulder, the two men sit on the steps of the Capitol, gazing down into the Mall on the uncountable thousands they have taken into their protection. Axel has a basket containing a thermos flask of ice-cold vodka, and the best gherkins and brown bread America can supply.
We made it, Sir Magnus, he breathes. We are home at last.
My dearest father, I am very pleased to be able to tell you of my new appointment. A cultural counsellor may not sound much to you, but it is a post that commands a deal of respect among the highest circles here, and even gets me into the White House. I am also the proud owner of what is called a cosmic pass, which means literally that no doors are closed to me anymore.